This one is tricky. Most of you have heard, I'm guessing, of Robert Rosenthal's psychological experiment from 1964. He went to an elementary school in San Francisco and administered a test which he said would predict which students had the capacity to increase their IQ scores. And he then chose 7 students from each class completely at random and told the teachers that these were the students who had the capacity to increase their IQ over time. And over the next 2 years, guess what? These students outperformed their peers and did increase their IQs, even though they had been completely chosen at random. In 1,000 small ways, their teachers encouraged them, giving them a little more time to answer questions, smiling and nodding at them, praising them when they were correct, and so on. They expected the students had the capacity to perform and taught accordingly, and what they expected came to pass. See, the stories we tell ourselves often become sort of self-fulfilling prophecies in a way. Some of you, I know, have seen Arthur Miller's play, The Price, which has been on at the Arena. And it's the story, at its heart, it's the story of 2 estranged brothers meeting to dispose of the contents of the apartment in which their father lived at the end of his life. And it became clear that the estrangement was the result of the very different stories they each told themselves about who they were in relation to their father and who he was in relation to them. One saw himself as drawing limits for a manipulative and dishonest old man, and the other saw himself as a good son, saving his father from being thrown on the streets during the Depression of the 30s. And it becomes clear over the course of the play that both stories are in some sense true, but also that they were irreconcilable without one or other of the brothers, or both perhaps, capitulating something important to their own understanding of who they were and how they lived and what their life was about, turning their life into a lie of sorts. This is what happens frequently in divorce. There are irreconcilable stories about what's been going on. It underlies many conflicts. We see it in the Middle East. The stories we tell ourselves matter, and they make a real difference in our lives. And so much psychotherapeutic work as a result is about helping us tell ourselves a more liberating story of our lives, claiming new possibilities, living more abundantly, flourishing, if you like. Well, so it is with one fairly traditional reading of Jesus' parable of the talents, a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy. What the slaves expected was what they got. A man going on a journey entrusted his property to his slaves, to each according to his ability. And the slaves responded to their responsibility in relation to the expectations the master had of each of them, but also in relation to the expectations that they had of the master. So the first 2 traded with talents, which was a huge amount of money, the talents entrusted to them, and they made more money. And after a long time, the master returned and received an accounting, and the first 2 were praised. But the third, the one who had buried his talent in the ground, was chastised and thrown into the outer darkness where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. I just want to share as an aside, in the New English Bible, which came, the first New Testament translation came out in 1961, and the translators in that very first edition, I have one, translated this parable as Jesus saying, the master saying to the third slave, "You lazy rascal." Now that doesn't quite capture, "You wicked and slothful creature." It's shocking. It's shocking. The servant said, "Master, I knew you were a harsh man, reaping where you didn't sow and gathering where you didn't scatter seed. So I was afraid and I went and hid your talent in the ground." Now, most of the people who would have been hearing Jesus tell this story, they would have been with the third character. They would have understood him. They knew about harsh masters. They disapproved of those who reaped without sowing and who made money without working for it. Isn't lending money for interest supposed to be against the law anyway? They would recognize harsh masters. They would recognize slaves who acted as though they had nothing to lose. Most of those listening to Jesus would have considered the action of the third slave to be wise and prudent. So what are we to make of the shocking ending, weeping, gnashing of teeth? Well, as I've hinted, our traditional reading suggests that we reap exactly what we sow. Maybe those first two slaves thought of God as generous, thought that this is a parable analogous to God, and God is generous, and if God is generous, then we can be generous, and abundance will flow. And the third slave thought of God as harsh and angry, and that's what he got, a harsh and angry God. So the stories we tell ourselves matter. The stories they told themselves in this reading mattered. And that's how we are perhaps to understand what is going on in the parable. This is, of course, a perfect reading in the season of our annual campaign for gifts and pledges to support the holy work we do in and through this community of faith in the year to come. Do not give out of shoulds and oughts, as though you will somehow be punished or you'll let the side down if you don't do your bit. Instead, be as generous as you can be, and then let your gift go and watch it multiply in concert with others. And one day you will hear a voice saying, "Well done, good and faithful servant. Enter the joy of your master." If you think of God as generous, you will discover that generosity, which I call a key spiritual practice of Christian community, you will discover that generosity is a way of not being enslaved to material anxiety. And so it's a way of claiming the promises of the gospel. Well, that reading is true as far as it goes. All good stuff. But we're not quite done with this parable, because we know that it's unlikely that Jesus is giving us an analogy for God in this parable. The master is a man. The kingdom of heaven is as a man going on a journey. Jesus is saying something about the kingdom of heaven or the reign or the rulership of God. See, his listeners would recognize the injustice of a world in which the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. He's not saying God is this capricious, angry master, is he? They'd recognize a world that those who are left behind by the master, by the markets, by fate, call it what you will, are punished further by the powers of this world. Surely the kingdom of heaven is not like that. Right, it's not. We're meant to be shocked by the outcome of this story. See, Jesus is in a string of parables, and as Jim pointed out last week, these judgment parables are all pointed towards the end game, which we'll hear next week. The end game is where the final judgment happens, and the sheep and the goats are sorted out at the last day. And there we learn that the only basis for judgment is how we treat the poor, how we treat those who are left behind, because that is where we are going to find God, among those people. As you did it to the least of these, so you did it to me, says Jesus. We will find Jesus among those whom the world casts into outer darkness, where there is weeping and gnashing of teeth. In a recent column in the New York Times, David Brooks mused on a distinction made by a British writer called David Goodhart. And Goodhart distinguishes, apparently, between somewheres and anywheres. And the way David Brooks explained it, I expect some of you saw it, he said, somewheres are rooted in their towns and have ascribed identities, Virginia farmer, West Virginia coal miner, Pennsylvania steel worker. Anywheres are at home in the global economy. They derive their identity more from portable traits like education or job skills, are more likely to move to areas of opportunity. Somewheres value staying put. They feel uncomfortable with many aspects of cultural and economic change, like mass immigration. Anywheres make educational attainment, David Brooks explains, the gold standard of status and are cheerleaders for restless change. Now, this is an analogy, and it doesn't all go all the way, but in our day and time, it is the somewheres who are frequently left behind, according to authors like J.D. Vance in his Hillbilly Elegy that I know many of you have read, and it's still on some of the bestseller lists. Now, while there are some among the homeless of our city who clearly move from city to city, they travel, most have been here a while. Most know this city. Most or it's important to them that this is somewhere, and they know how to manage this particular place. In the parable of the talents, Jesus is at some level insisting that we just cannot accept a world in which the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. He's insisting on a world in which those who are treated harshly by harsh masters, markets, fate, whatever we want to name, Jesus is in effect insisting those people not be forgotten, and that the anywheres not leave the somewheres behind. It's part, perhaps, of what it means when the Gospels and St. Paul muse on what it means to be in the world and not of it. By all means, strive to be an anywhere, but do not lose touch with your somewhere, with your place. The kingdom of heaven is certainly a state in which generosity begets courage, which begets generosity, and so on. But it's also a state in which we are horrified by abusive treatment of those who are left behind by this world. The kingdom of heaven is a state in which we are judged by how we treat one another in need, how we reflect the community that is envisioned in the Torah, the community of God's economy, in which there is abundance for everyone, no one left behind, the widow and the poor and the orphan and the stranger. In God's economy, there is abundance for everyone. Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you something to drink? When did we see you a stranger and invite you in, or needing clothes and clothe you? When did we see you sick or in prison and go visit you? And the Lord will reply, truly I tell you, whatever you did for one of the least of these brothers and sisters of mine, whatever you did for the people you meet who are left behind, whatever you did for those in need, you did for me. In our customary time of silence for prayer, I invite you to use it as ever how you will, but perhaps consider your own practices of generosity. If you've not yet made a pledge, and many thanks to those of you who have, you might pray about that. You might also ask that your eyes be opened to those in your circles, your path, who have been left behind, who are weak or broken or in some need, and what it could mean to be in the same community with them, to live under the rulership of God in the kingdom of heaven. In silence and in response to the gospel, let us pray.